I did not hear his voice first or see his face in a photograph before I understood what had happened, because what reached me instead was a sequence of movements laid out in reports and phone records, a progression of choices that looked ordinary until they converged in a stretch of northern woods where nothing about the place suggested it would become permanent for anyone. And as I traced how a routine drive turned into a disappearance that resisted explanation, I kept returning to the same quiet contradiction. That the person at the center trusted the people guiding him and followed directions that did not feel dangerous at the time, because the danger had been disguised as concern, as protection, as a plan meant to keep him safe. The file did not announce itself with chaos or confusion, but with deliberate steps, verified communications, and a methodological narrowing of options that only becomes visible when the end is already known, and when the final name appeared at the bottom of the opening summary. It was the first moment the story allowed me to attach a human identity to the outcome. Jonathan Amoureux. I first encountered Jonathan Amoureux through employment records and statements taken long before anyone used the word victim to describe him, because the earliest documents treated him as a working professional whose days were defined by schedules, commutes, and responsibilities that did not intersect with criminal investigations. He was trained as an engineer, employed in a technical role that required precision and consistency, and the people who worked alongside him described a man who showed up prepared and who handled problems through methodical thinking rather than confrontation. When I reviewed those accounts, what stood out was not a dramatic personality trait, but an absence of volatility, which would later matter when the narrative around his final days was reconstructed from verified sources. Jonathan's personal relationships were documented less cleanly than his professional life, which is often the case in investigations where private dynamics only become visible under pressure. Court records and sworn testimony established that he was involved in a romantic relationship with Samantha Perry, a woman whose background and beliefs would later be scrutinized in detail during the legal process. At the time, however, the relationship appeared functional on the surface, with shared travel, communication, and planning that did not raise alarms to outside observers. What I am careful to note here is that none of the early records describe open conflict or fear, only a pattern of closeness that would later be reinterpreted through the lens of what followed. As the investigation would later confirm, Samantha Perry maintained contact with Tyler Anderson, a former partner whose role became central once the case moved from missing person to homicide. The nature of those communications was not speculative, because investigators obtained digital records that showed ongoing exchanges, and those records became foundational evidence during trial. At the time they were sent, however, they were not visible to Jonathan, and there is no evidence that he was aware of the extent to which decisions about his movements were being discussed by others without his knowledge. That asymmetry of information is one of the few interpretive observations that remains firmly grounded in evidence, because it is supported by what was and was not accessible to him. The belief systems influencing Samantha Perry and Tyler Anderson were addressed extensively in court, but only after they were documented through statements, online activity, and corroborated testimony. Investigators and prosecutors described a worldview shaped by paranoia and conspiracy thinking, including the belief that Jonathan posed a threat that needed to be neutralized. It is important to state this carefully, because the conclusion did not come from rumor or assumption, but from direct admissions and messages entered into evidence. Before any crime occurred, those beliefs existed as internal justifications, invisible to the person they were directed against. In the days leading up to Jonathan's disappearance, his communications reflected routine planning rather than distress, a point that was later confirmed through phone data and witness statements. He agreed to travel, following directions that were presented to him as necessary for safety and privacy, and there is no evidence that he anticipated harm. When I reviewed those records, I noted how ordinary the logistics appeared, because the route, timing, and purpose were framed as reasonable within the context he was given. That framing would later become central to understanding how control was exerted without overt force. The location chosen for the meeting was a wooded area in Dummer, New Hampshire, a rural setting that did not immediately suggest criminal intent to someone unfamiliar with its isolation. Investigators later confirmed that the area provided seclusion, limited visibility, and minimal chance of interruption, characteristics that were not coincidental, but aligned with the planning that had taken place. At the time Jonathan traveled there, however, those same characteristics could be interpreted simply as remoteness, rather than danger. That distinction is critical, because it explains how a person could enter such an environment without triggering internal alarms. What followed in those woods has been reconstructed through forensic evidence, admissions, and corroborated timelines, not through speculation or narrative embellishment. Jonathan Emerald was shot and killed, and the act was carried out by Tyler Anderson, with Samantha Perry present and participating in the events surrounding the killing. This conclusion was not immediate, because the case initially unfolded as a missing person investigation, with family members reporting Jonathan's absence when he failed to return and could not be reached. The transition from concern to suspicion occurred only after inconsistencies emerged and verified information contradicted initial explanations. When Jonathan was reported missing, law enforcement began the process of tracking his last known movements, relying on phone pings, vehicle sightings, and interviews with people who had recent contact with him. Samantha Perry's statements became part of that early inquiry, and while some elements aligned with available data, others did not withstand scrutiny as more information was gathered. Investigators documented these discrepancies methodically, preserving them for later comparison rather than drawing premature conclusions. That restraint is evident in the case file and reflects standard investigative practice rather than hesitation. As the search continued, attention turned to Tyler Anderson, whose proximity to Samantha Perry and whose recorded communications placed him within the orbit of Jonathan's disappearance. Law enforcement obtained warrants that allowed deeper examination of digital records, and those records revealed planning discussions that reframed earlier assumptions about the nature of the trip to Dahmer. What had appeared to be a consensual meeting now showed signs of orchestration, with specific instructions and contingencies discussed in advance. These findings shifted the investigation decisively. The recovery of Jonathan's body did not occur immediately, because the perpetrators took steps to conceal the crime after the killing. Investigators later confirmed that his remains were buried in a shallow grave and subsequently moved, with an attempt made to destroy evidence through burning in a different location in northern New Hampshire. Each of these actions was established to physical evidence and admissions, forming a chain of events that could be verified independently. The effort to obscure the truth, while unsuccessful, added layers to the case that required careful disentanglement. When arrests were made, they were supported by a body of evidence that included forensic findings, digital communications, and direct statements. Tyler Anderson and Samantha Perry were charged and later convicted for their roles in Jonathan Amoral's murder, outcomes that were reached through the judicial process rather than narrative assumption. Sentencing records reflect the seriousness with which the court viewed the planning and execution of the crime, as well as the impact on Jonathan's family and community. Those records are part of the public file and require no interpretive leap to understand their significance. Before the case reached that point, however, Jonathan Amoral existed in the records as a man whose life was interrupted without warning and whose final days appeared unremarkable until they were examined in reverse. As I moved through the early portions of the file, I was struck by how little drama preceded the violence, because the absence of overt conflict is itself a documented fact. It underscores how control, when exercised quietly and supported by belief systems detached from reality, can operate without immediate resistance. That understanding does not add meaning beyond the evidence, but it does explain how the sequence unfolded as it did. This chapter ends before the moment of confrontation, not because it avoids the act itself, but because understanding what came before requires attention to the ordinary patterns that were exploited. Jonathan Amoral was not drawn into chaos, but guided through routine decisions that had been repurposed by others toward a lethal end. Everything described here is grounded in testimony records and confirmed findings, and it establishes the foundation necessary to examine the moment when planning became action. When the case moved from reconstruction to confrontation, I relied on what could be confirmed rather than what might have been imagined, because the evidence describing Jonathan Amoral's final hours existed in physical form, digital records, and sworn admissions that left little room for interpretation. The sequence began with his arrival in the wooded area of Dahmer, New Hampshire, a location selected for its remoteness and later identified through cell phone data, vehicle tracking, and site-specific forensic work. I reviewed those materials in the order they were collected, because understanding the moment required respecting the chronology established by investigators, rather than rearranging it for narrative effect. Jonathan arrived as instructed, following directions that were communicated to him through channels verified during the investigation, and there is no evidence that he deviated from the plan he believed he was participating in. Samantha Perry was present, and her proximity to him at that point was not disputed during trial, because she later acknowledged being there. Tyler Anderson arrived separately, a fact confirmed through both his own statements and corroborating evidence that placed him at the scene. The convergence of these three individuals in that specific location marked the point where planning transitioned into action. The interaction that followed has been described in court using precise language, stripped of embellishment, because it was reconstructed through admissions rather than third-party speculation. Tyler Anderson produced a firearm, and Jonathan Amall was shot. The number of shots, their trajectory, and the cause of death were established through autopsy findings and ballistic analysis, which confirmed that the injuries were fatal and inflicted at close range. There was no evidence presented that Jonathan was armed or that he posed an immediate physical threat at the time he was killed. What stands out in the documentation is the absence of chaos in the planning phase and the sudden finality of the act itself, because the killing was not the result of an escalating argument captured on recording or witnessed by bystanders. Instead, it occurred in isolation, witnessed only by the people who had orchestrated the meeting. Samantha Perry's presence during the shooting was later acknowledged, and her role was examined in detail during legal proceedings, with the court determining that her actions before and after the killing met the threshold for criminal responsibility. After Jonathan was shot, the focus of those involved shifted immediately to concealment, a transition that was later confirmed through physical evidence and admissions. His body was buried in a shallow grave in the wooded area, an act that required time, tools, and coordination, none of which occurred spontaneously. Investigators later identified the burial site through a combination of search efforts and information provided after arrests were made, and forensic examination confirmed that the remains had been placed deliberately. The concealment did not end with burial, and this is where the record becomes particularly detailed, because subsequent actions left a trail of evidence that could be traced backward. Jonathan's body was later exhumed and transported to a different location in northern New Hampshire, where attempts were made to further destroy evidence through burning. Fire investigators and forensic specialists documented the site, collecting remnants that could be analyzed and linked to Jonathan through DNA testing. These findings were entered into evidence and played a significant role in establishing the full scope of what occurred after the killing. During this period, Jonathan was officially listed as a missing person, and law enforcement activity intensified as his absence raised concerns among family members and colleagues. I reviewed the missing person reports alongside the later homicide file, because the contrast between what was known publicly at the time and what had already occurred privately was stark. While search efforts were underway, the people responsible for his death were actively working to ensure that he would not be found, a fact established through their own later admissions. Digital evidence became critical in narrowing the timeline, because phone records, text messages, and location data provided objective markers that could not be altered by memory or reinterpretation. Investigators obtained warrants that allowed them to examine these records, and patterns emerged that contradicted initial explanations offered by Samantha Perry. Those inconsistencies were documented carefully, with each discrepancy noted and preserved for later comparison rather than confronted immediately. That approach allowed investigators to build a case grounded in verification rather than confrontation. Tyler Anderson's role became increasingly clear as evidence accumulated, particularly when his statements began to align with physical findings in ways that could not be coincidental. During questioning, he admitted to shooting Jonathan Amaro, an admission that was corroborated by ballistic evidence and the medical examiner's conclusions. His account of the events following the shooting, including burial and attempts to destroy the body, matched what investigators had already discovered at the relevant sites. This convergence of confession and corroboration removed ambiguity from the central act of the case. Samantha Perry's involvement was examined separately, but with equal rigor, because her actions before, during, and after the killing were documented through messages, travel records, and her own statements. And prosecutors presented evidence showing that she had participated in planning and had taken steps to assist in concealing the crime, findings that were ultimately accepted by the court. The distinction between presence and participation was addressed directly, and the verdict reflected a determination based on evidence rather than association alone. As the investigation transitioned into prosecution, the focus shifted from establishing what had happened to demonstrating it within the framework of the law. I reviewed trial transcripts, where forensic experts explained their findings in plain terms, ensuring that the cause and manner of death were understood without reliance on graphic detail. Digital forensic specialists testified about how location data and message histories were recovered and authenticated, reinforcing the reliability of the timeline presented. Each piece of evidence was introduced methodically, reinforcing the sequence rather than overwhelming it. The moment itself, when Jonathan Amaro was killed, was never presented as a mystery once the evidence was assembled, because the admissions and corroborating findings aligned too closely to allow alternative interpretations. There was no competing narrative supported by evidence, and no credible dispute about who fired the shots or where they occurred. What remained contested during trial were the motivations and beliefs that led to the planning, but those were addressed through documented communications rather than inferred psychology. The court's findings reflected that distinction, focusing on actions rather than internal states. By the time the jury reached its verdicts, the case had moved far beyond the uncertainty that defined the early missing person phase. The killing of Jonathan Amaro was established as a deliberate act carried out in a specific place, at a specific time, by identified individuals whose roles were supported by evidence. The attempts to conceal the crime, while extensive, ultimately added to the body of proof rather than erasing it. Each step taken after the shooting created new points of verification that investigators could follow. This chapter centers on the moment because it is where planning became irreversible, but it does not isolate that moment from the actions surrounding it, because doing so would misrepresent how the case was proven. Jonathan Amaro's death was not reconstructed through inference, but through a chain of evidence that linked intention, action, and aftermath in a continuous sequence. Everything described here comes directly from investigative findings, forensic analysis, and sworn testimony, forming the factual core around which the rest of the case was resolved. By the time the case entered its final phase, the uncertainty that marked Jonathan Amaro's disappearance had been replaced by a documented record of events supported by evidence rather than conjecture. The investigation no longer revolved around where he might be, but around how the legal system would process what had already been established through forensic work, digital analysis, and sworn admissions. My role at this stage involved reviewing outcomes, verifying conclusions, and ensuring that the narrative reflected what was proven in court rather than what had merely been suspected during earlier stages. The prosecution of Tyler Anderson and Samantha Perry unfolded through formal proceedings that adhered to established legal standards, with each charge tied to specific actions supported by evidence. Tyler Anderson was charged with first-degree murder, a designation reflecting the court's determination that the killing of Jonathan Amaro was premeditated and intentional. Samantha Perry faced charges including accomplice to first-degree murder and witness tampering, based on evidence showing her involvement in planning and her actions after the killing. These charges were not symbolic, but grounded in statutes applied to facts presented during trial. During court proceedings, jurors were presented with a chronological reconstruction of events, beginning with the communications that preceded Jonathan's trip to Dummer and ending with the recovery and identification of his remains. The prosecution relied on testimony from law enforcement officers, forensic experts, digital analysts, and medical professionals, each of whom addressed a specific component of the case. Their statements were supported by exhibits, including message logs, location data, photographs of relevant sites, and forensic reports, all of which were subject to cross-examination. The process emphasized verification over narrative persuasion. Tyler Anderson's admissions played a central role in the resolution of the case because they aligned closely with independent findings rather than standing alone. His statements regarding the shooting, burial, and subsequent attempts to destroy evidence were corroborated by physical locations, forensic traces, and timelines established through technology. The court evaluated these admissions within the context of corroboration, ensuring that they were not accepted without supporting evidence. This approach reduced reliance on any single source and strengthened the overall evidentiary framework. Samantha Perry's case required separate consideration because her defense centered on the nature and extent of her participation rather than a denial of presence. Prosecutors presented evidence showing that she had facilitated the meeting that brought Jonathan to the wooded area, had remained present during the killing, and had assisted in actions taken to conceal a crime. Digital communications were particularly important in establishing her role, as they demonstrated planning and coordination that extended beyond passive association. The court's findings reflected a determination that her actions met the legal threshold for criminal responsibility. When verdicts were reached, they were the result of deliberation, grounded in evidence, rather than emotional appeal. Tyler Anderson was convicted of first-degree murder and later sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, a sentence mandated by law for that conviction in New Hampshire. Samantha Perry was convicted on multiple counts, including accomplice to first-degree murder, and received a substantial prison sentence reflecting her role in the crime. These outcomes were documented in sentencing records and reflected the court's application of statutory requirements rather than discretionary judgment alone. The sentencing phase also included victim impact statements, a procedural component that allowed Jonathan Amaral's family to address the court directly. While these statements did not alter the legal findings, they were part of the official record and acknowledged the personal consequences of the crime. The court recognized these statements without allowing them to influence the established facts or the statutory framework governing sentencing. Their inclusion underscored the distinction between legal resolution and personal loss. Following sentencing, the case entered a period of procedural finality, with appeals and post-conviction considerations addressed through established legal channels. Court records show that the convictions were upheld, reinforcing the stability of the findings reached during trial. At this stage, the investigation no longer involved active evidence gathering, but focused on record maintenance in compliance with custodial requirements. The case file transitioned from active to closed, reflecting its completion within the criminal justice system. What remains of Jonathan Amaral's case exists in multiple forms, including legal records, investigative reports, and the physical evidence preserved according to protocol. These materials serve as a permanent account of what occurred, accessible for review and subject to scrutiny within the boundaries of the law. They do not offer interpretation beyond what was established during proceedings, nor do they attempt to assign meaning beyond documented outcomes. Their purpose is to preserve accuracy rather than narrative. From an investigative standpoint, the case illustrates how methodical documentation and corroboration can bring clarity to events initially obscured by deliberate concealment. The attempts to hide Jonathan's death ultimately generated additional evidence, creating a more detailed record rather than erasing it. Each action taken after the killing introduced new variables that investigators could analyze, reinforcing the sequence rather than disrupting it. This outcome was not the result of chance, but of systematic investigative practices applied consistently. The conclusion of the case does not redefine Jonathan Amaral by the manner of his death, because the records preceding the crime establish him as a person with a life and identity separate from the investigation that followed. Employment histories, personal correspondence, and testimony from those who knew him provide context without speculation, allowing his existence to be documented beyond the final act that ended it. This distinction is maintained throughout the official record and reflected in how the case is archived. In closing the file, I am left with a complete, verified account that begins with routine interactions and ends with legal resolution, without gaps filled by assumption. The evidence supports a clear sequence of events. The court has rendered its judgments, and the outcomes are recorded without ambiguity. What remains is not a mystery or an unresolved question, but a factual record of a crime, its investigation, and its adjudication, preserved as part of the public record.